funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can we learn from examining all the text and information we've put into print over the course of human history? For centuries, of course, that question was merely rhetorical, since even the most sophisticated analog record keeping could barely scratch the surface of any attempt to analyze so much data. But the digital age has yielded remarkable new tools for tracking human knowledge and thought, leading my guest and his research partner to a new field of study they call culturomics, a discipline that encompasses language, culture, and history. Eras Aden is director of the Center for Genome Architecture at Baylor College of Medicine and at Rice University, and assistant professor of computer science and applied mathematics at Rice University. His new book, written with Jean-Baptiste Michel of Harvard, is called "Uncharted: Big Data as a Lens on Human Culture." Eras, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Will you start by talking us through how you found your way to culturomics from a background in genetics and in computer science?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the things that has been very, very striking in the past few decades has been the ways in which the analysis of the human genome has transformed the character of biology from a field that relied in large part on very qualitative analyses to a field that has become extraordinarily quantitative, extraordinarily reliant on computational methods in the wake of the ability to sequence the human genome, to understand what that sequence of letters is that encodes for the instructions that make life what it is. That thinking about that space, you know, and the ways in which the human genome, this massive data set, and, you know, our ability to interrogate the human genome transformed the character of biology led, you know, my colleagues JB and I to wonder whether similar transformations were waiting to happen in other fields. Where there'd be, you know, opportunities for new types of methods, complementing existing methods. And one of the things that we hit on was the possibility of trying to use these sort of approaches to study human history. Because one of the things that was really happening, especially in the wake of the Google Books project, is for the first time a significant chunk of the human historical record started to be digitized, started to be made available in some sort of form where a computer can tell you something about it, can help you analyze it. And so we sort of wondered, you know, hey, is there a possibility that the digital historical record could open the door to the types of computational and quantitative methods for problems that were traditionally in the humanities, problems that were traditionally the purview of history, in the same way that the sequencing of the human genome opened that door for biology.
And when you guys got started, big data wasn't even a thing people were really talking about very much yet, but you had a professor who encouraged you to simply explore the most fascinating question you could find, and yours turned out to be a deceptively simple one.
Yeah, that's quite right. So we were working with Martin Novak at the Program for Evolutionary Dynamics at Harvard University. And Martin is a very, you know, sort of freewheeling intellectual spirit, and, you know, he gave us a lot. He gave us a pretty wide berth. And we got really, really fascinated by the following, you know, little problem, which is, why is it that, you know, if I drive today, I say that yesterday I drove, instead of saying that yesterday I drived? It's kind of like a strange quirk, because most of the time, if you have a verb, you say it in the present tense in English, then to say it in the past tense, you just add ed. Mm-hmm. But for certain verbs, like the verb drive, the past tense is irregular. Instead of saying drive, you say drove. So we wondered, basically, what was going on with that. How did that come to be? And that question sort of led us to the cusp of quantitative research on traditionally historical problems.
And amazingly, the path to the answer sort of starts with Charles Darwin.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So I think one of the things that people have talked about in the context of culture for a very long time is this notion that culture evolves in the same way that organisms evolve. And today, and I would say, you know, especially 10 years ago and even today, this is a little bit of a strange notion, right? I mean, it's not very clear, you know, that this is, you know, how meaningful this is. I mean, in the context of biology, when you say that something evolves, that has some teeth, mm-hmm. right? You can write down some equations, you can make some predictions based on the notion of, you know, evolution functioning in a certain sort of way. And those predictions, you know, are testable and often satisfied very, very, you know, very dramatic ways by the data. There's a notion of natural selection in biology where certain sorts of traits can be selected for. Whether it could be evolutionary pressure driving you to exhibit a certain trait because it gives you an advantage in your environment. In the context of language and culture, people don't really think that way very much. But this is actually and so people will sometimes use this terminology of culture evolves, language evolves, but it's unclear to us whether this was actually really very meaningful. Because, you know, well, you know, could you make predictions on that basis? It was unclear. It was very striking as you look back at the work of Charles Darwin, the situation is actually completely reversed. So in Darwin's day, you know, he had this idea that, you know, was a very incendiary concept, you know, then as now, you know, of evolution. And it was just in, you know, in the scientific literature, this was a completely new idea. That, you know, species developed via natural selection by mutation and natural selection. And, you know, it's very, very strange. And he wanted to try to convince other scientists that this wasn't crazy. And the analogy that he drew is actually a very, very striking analogy. So he actually drew an analogy to language. He said, because in his day, actually, the notion, you know, there's a very strong, people tended to do actually a lot of work in historical linguistics. There's a bit more of a historical bent to linguistics in that day. And people actually had a pretty, you know, well-accepted notions that to some extent languages had evolved from common ancestors and then kind of differentiated in different contexts, you know. So, you know, for instance, you know, English and Dutch and German all come from a shared origin. He actually appealed to that. He said, look, biological evolution, right, evolution is the origin of species, that's not such a foreign notion. That's pretty similar to what we think happens with languages. I just think that it happens with organisms as well. And so that was actually very, very striking to us. I mean, this notion that, you know, here was, you know, none other than Charles Darwin trying to convince people that, you know, biology evolves, that organisms evolve, that species evolve, and he, you know, finds himself sort of forced to draw on this argument that, like, well, of course, biology can evolve. That's totally reasonable because we all know that culture and language evolve. And so it seemed to us that, you know, this idea, which in some sense had fallen out of fashion over the centuries of evolution being a powerful tool for the understanding of linguistic change, the understanding of cultural change, was one that might be valuable to revisit.
And so along comes a guy named George Kingsley Zipf. Can you tell us about him?
Sure, absolutely. So George Kingsley Zipf was this remarkable fellow. He was a professor of German at Harvard in the early 20th century. And he became, he started to read books in a funny way. I think that's really, in some sense, the best way to describe it. He, you know, look, this guy was, you know, a scholar of literature. He understood, you know, how to deeply appreciate, you know, the flower of literary genius, as it were. But he kind of got obsessed with a very, very different way, a very sort of deconstructive way of looking at text, which is that he would just go through, read text, To some extent, is benefiting from others who kind of helped with this process. But basically, the idea was to read text and just count how often different words appeared. Hmm. And this regularity, and he actually found that that there was a pattern. And the pattern was kind of a pretty interesting pattern. So if you could list all the words that appear in a text in order, so that each word has a rank, right? There's the top ranked word. It's the most frequent word, right? It's the most frequent word typically. So it's the top ranked word. There's the next ranked word, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So every word has a rank. Every word also has a frequency. How often does it appear in the text? And he noticed this funky thing, which is that the word that appeared sort of tenth most often typically appeared about 10 times as often as the word that appeared 100th as often. So basically, if you multiplied the rank of a word by its frequency, it was a constant. Something that's 100 times high, has 100 times higher rank, will have 100 times higher frequency. So you have to divide the rank by the frequency, and that gives you a constant. Anyway, that was weird. That's just a weird thing. Like, why the heck is that going on? I mean, to this day, right, you kind of wonder about that. That's just a strange, strange, strange phenomenon. And, you know, it was a phenomenon that really got people very, very excited. And just to be accurate, you know, there are a few folks who had noticed this before Zipf did, but Zipf did a lot of the work to kind of systematize these studies, to do them at a scale that they hadn't been done before, to synthesize them in a way that got people really, really fascinated. And Zipf was a polarizing figure. You know, some people said, this is just crazy, right? But then others said, some people said, this is just crazy. This is not a way to read a text. And then others, you know, turned around and said, hey, but he found this crazy pattern, this crazy regularity, which if you take the rank divided by the frequency, you always get a constant. And, you know, why in the world would that be? And they just were fascinated by that. And they were fascinated by the fact that that suggested a wholly new way of thinking about language. And I think what you really take from Zipf's work is this notion that there is there's people to this day who, you know, don't think, you know, Zipf's work was that interesting, because they say, look, books are meant to be, you know, read in the traditional fashion, appreciated in the traditional fashion. This kind of weird looking for quantitative patterns is not helpful. But there's a lot of others who actually think quite the opposite. In fact, the study of the kinds of regularities that Zipf discovered, first reported in language, he later found them in city size, they've later been reported in, you know, the size of holes in Swiss cheese obeys the same kind of regularity, where if you rank the holes in your Swiss cheese by size and you multiply them by the actual size of the hole, this satisfies, you know, the value turns out to be a constant, right? Some Swiss cheese constant. So it's strange, right? There's these patterns all over the place. And so there's this rich tradition that Zipf really created that spans, it spans linguistics, it spans, urban design, it spans physics, it spans biology, it spans chemistry, and it spans almost all the sciences. Just because he found these just funny-looking patterns. It's an amazing legacy for a professor of German. But what I really want to point out, that was a driving idea for us, is that Zipf, unlike, in some sense, his predecessors, understood that there were other ways to read a text, other ways to extract meaningful information from a text, other than the standard way to read. And he discovered a new type of reading.
We will come back to this in just a minute with Erez Aydin, director of the Center for Genome Architecture at Baylor College of Medicine and assistant professor of computer science and applied mathematics at Rice. His new book is called Uncharted: Big Data as a Lens on Human Culture.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you: the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Erez Aydin, who is Assistant Professor of Computer Science and Applied Mathematics at Rice University and co-author of the new book Uncharted, Big Data as a Lens on Human Culture. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Erez, I think people are probably wondering how all of this relates to big data. We will get to that in just a moment. But just quickly summarize for people who've gotten curious now, why it is that irregular verbs seem to be some of the most commonly used verbs in the English language.
So what we discovered in our early studies on this is that it turns out that, this first thing was known, very, very well known by linguists beforehand, which is there used to be a lot more irregular verbs. For instance, the past tense of the verb help used to be hope, but now it's helped. So what's happening is that irregular verbs are disappearing. Another interesting thing is new verbs, when they enter the language, like Google. Today I Google something, yesterday I Googled it. New verbs that enter the language are entirely regular. So what's happening is that you, in some sense, have this endangered species of irregular verbs that are slowly disappearing. And what we found, and this was really confirming some hypotheses that linguists had proposed years before, but we were able to sort of look at them with great sort of quantitative precision and see that that's what was happening, is that verbs that are used less frequently seem to regularize more often. So think about it this way. I mean, let's say the past tense of spelunk, to go caving, was spelided, as opposed to spelunked.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. How the heck many people know that word and are going to remember that past tense? Not terribly many. It's going to be easily forgotten on the individual level. Sometimes it seems like what happens on the social level is similar, where as a society, as a group, we just tend to forget about rare irregular verbs, and so they've been disappearing. What was actually quite interesting is that you can actually measure that rate of disappearance, and it turns out that the rate of disappearance is very closely related to frequency of the verb. In fact, you can actually treat irregular verbs as though they were radioactive atoms. And radioactive atoms tend to sort of disappear with this half-life, so after a certain amount of time, half of them are gone. Irregular verbs are the same way, and you can actually calculate what their half-life is going to be. It turns out to be proportional to the square root of their frequency. So a verb that is 100 times less frequent is going to regularize 10 times as fast. And using that, we can do fun things like, predict which irregular verbs are likely to transition next, how many irregular verbs will be left in 2500, et cetera, et cetera.
The perfect union of math and English.
But a union of math and English. I'm not sure we found, the perfect union, but maybe we can say that we are, it is a more perfect union of math and English than is commonly found.
All right, so let's talk about Google Books and your idea to sort of focus your work on this project. Start with this. How are all those books uploaded in the first place, the actual process for converting hard copies into searchable digital files?
So Google in 2004 started this project to digitize every single book that had ever been published. In fact, it was slightly more ambitious. They wanted to publish every edition of every single book that had ever been published. And the way they did that was two things. The first is they reached out to publishers and said, please send us your books. Please send us any books that you have in inventory. We would like to scan them. And in that case, they got these books that were not terribly important to anybody in the sense that there were many, many copies of them around. They were not rare. And so they could take the individual physical book and chop it up into little bits and then run it through what they call a destructive scanning process. It's not that that's a little bit less impressive. But they realized that they weren't going to get, much historical value in some sense out of that. A big chunk of what, Larry Page, who is really currently the CEO of Google, one of Google's co-founders, was really the driving force behind Google Books. What he wanted to do was to somehow be able to digitize all historical books. And so he and Marissa Mayer, who turns out actually now to be the CEO of Yahoo, but at the time was at Google, he said, well, how hard would it be if we went and we actually tried to scan in all the books that are in libraries? So take books that we can't destroy because they're sensitive, because it might be the only copy, the rare book room of a particular library. How long would it take to just flip through them? And actually, he and Marissa Mayer went through and used a metronome to pace themselves as they simply flipped through all the pages of a book. And they concluded that it was simply possible to digitize every single book on the planet in a relatively short period of time by just hiring an army of people to page through books one at a time and take pictures as they go. And so that's where these books come from. There are, numerous partner libraries all over the world. Many of the biggest libraries in the world work with Google. They will send them books, not just, a book at a time or a shelf at a time, but a whole building, a whole wing at a time. And Google has an army of page turners that turns the page, flips its way from one end of the book to another. And they've just been paging through billions of pages. And Google takes a picture each time. They then digitally correct for things like the curvature of the page. They identify all the letters on the page and transform it into a text document that you can then search on the internet. And that is basically the Google Books project. At this point, Google has digitized about 20% of all books ever published. It's really a just incredibly ambitious and bold effort. And for JB and I, it was fascinating because here what Google had done is they'd taken a significant aspect of the historical record, namely books, and they said, well, we're just going to try to digitize a meaningful fraction of it. In fact, they're trying to digitize all of it, but they'd already, by 2007, 2008, digitized a meaningful fraction of it, and this was unprecedented. I mean, to have a significant chunk of the historical record going back many centuries in a digital form that was susceptible to analysis, that was just a radically new type of big data, if you will. And I want to highlight how it's different than, so people talk about big data, and I'm sure that we're going to get to that in the balance of the conversation, these very, very, very large data sets. But the truth of the matter is most very large data sets are actually short data, because what creates a large data set? Often it's like a computer or some piece of modern technology that creates this massive data set. You have to have, the ability to store huge amounts of information and intake huge amounts of information, record huge amounts of information. That's a great way to generate a big data set. Google's big data was very different. It was big data, but it wasn't short data. It was actually long data, right? It took the legacy of the last media revolution, namely the printing press, and said, let's take all of those bits that were ever recorded by the printing press or ever disseminated by the printing press, and let's put them all in one place. And so it had many of the aspects of big data in terms of its sheer size, its sheer scope. But it has these completely new facets that come from its awe-inspiring longevity.
I know that there are significant copyright issues that have been raised, and I don't mean to minimize those, but I sort of love the spirit of the project simply because it feels a little bit like backdating the internet to, the 14th century.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's, when you're kind of hacking with these sort of like, big data sets, there's very, very, very few contexts where you can be learning about, the Renaissance, the Civil War, that these kinds of projects have that character, and Google Books data has that character where, you can learn about, the U.S. during the Civil War. You can learn about the legacy of, China's Cultural Revolution. You can learn about all kinds of things that you would typically have learned about only in a history book, in a history textbook. And suddenly you're learning about them this radical new way from this radically new perspective. And, I don't want to claim that this is better than what we had before, by no means. I think there are multiple ways to learn about the historical record, to learn about our history, but it's different. And I think different when it's combined with existing techniques in the right way can be good. It can open up new doors.
So, Erez, there are millions of ways, literally, that one could decide to take this data and process it so that people can search it. Talk about how you and your colleagues decided on how what is now called the Google Ngram Viewer would function and how results would be displayed and why those searches were of interest with regard to the work that you were doing.
Sure, absolutely. Well, as you mentioned before, there's a lot of copyright issues. I mean, in general, whenever you have these big data sets, you know, someone somewhere is, especially when they're big data sets that pertain to the human historical record, like Twitter, someone somewhere has created the data, has some sort of rights over it. You know, like, you know, it's reasonable for someone who tweets on Twitter, you know, to think that other people aren't going to just take their tweets and, you know, publish them in their own name as some sort of masterpiece. Books, you know, are obviously the same way. I mean, books were created by authors who have every reason to believe that they ought to be able to, you know, profit on some level from their hard work. And as such, there is copyright legislation that protects the author's prerogatives. That said, the copyright legislation that exists right now predates the whole digital book revolution, and you know it may need a refresh. But we kind of, you know, we're not in the position to do anything about that. We just asked ourselves this question of, well, okay, we have these books, but the vast majority of them are under copyright. So I can't just take all these digital books and promulgate them to the scientific community and then do a whole bunch of analyses on them. What we wanted to do was we wanted to show the power of this kind of analysis. And Google was very, very generous and gave us access. And it was really, you know, Peter Norvig and Dan Clancy at Google were major drivers in terms of getting us access to the data. And that was great. But we didn't want to just do our own analysis on the data. We wanted to create a resource that the whole scientific community and, in fact, the whole sort of general public could use to do their own explorations, you know, because, you know, all of us together are smarter than, you know, one or two of us. And so we wanted to figure out how we could create some sort of data resource that everyone could use that would not violate the copyrights of the authors. And there is this premise of, there's this principle in copyright law, fair use, that certain kinds of uses of copyrighted text constitute fair use. And JB and I reasoned to ourselves that the following would be pretty neat and should seem to us like fair use, which is, let's take all of these books, including huge numbers of books that are under copyright, and let's take every single word and phrase that exists in the English language with non-negligible frequency. So the phrase might be somebody's name. It might be George Washington. It might be, quote, like "Hail to the Chief," right? Anything that appears with non-negligible frequency in the English historical record, we're going to make a table that shows for every single one of those phrases how frequently it appears over time, year by year, going back 5 centuries. And of course, there's a lot of words and phrases in the English language. There's about 2 billion entries in our table. So, you know, lots and lots of information there. And we reasoned that that ought to be fair use, that creating such a table and distributing such a table ought to be fair use. You know, at the time there was some debate actually about whether, you know, was that the right thing to do? You know, was that really fair use? No one had really applied fair use in quite that way. But actually, you know, subsequently a lot of the decisions by the various courts in all the lawsuits that surround Google Books have actually upheld this notion that Ngram datasets and datasets like them are actually fair use and appeal to our work. And so that was kind of, you know, neat that our, you know, sort of like legal moonshine, you know, idea ultimately, you know, was able to have an influence on contemporary copyright thinking. But I want to just kind of give some examples, really, of the power of this very, very, very simple trick. So let's take a simple example. So where does the notion, for instance, of like Martians come from? When did people start getting, you know, really, really interested in the notion of Martians. And, you know, you might think it's a whole bunch of, you know, there's a bunch of different ideas that people have of when people started thinking about Martians. But you can look in the Ngram Viewer, and what you see in the Ngram Viewer, and the Ngram Viewer is just a website that we created which allows one to type in a word or phrase, and it will show you a chart showing its frequency over time. And what you see when you type in Martians into the Ngram Viewer is that basically, you know, in the mid-1890s, people start to really talk about Martians. And then since then, the frequency has just been getting higher and higher and higher and higher. So you can ask yourself, well, what the heck happened in the mid, you know, sort of 1890s that drove this discussion of Martians? And, you know, to some extent, that involves a little bit of speculation. Invariably, right, there's some degree of speculation. The Ngram tells you sort of what happens. It doesn't necessarily tell you why. But it's pretty clear that in this particular case, what the underlying mechanism was, which is that this guy named Percival Lowell, in the 1890s, he was a very wealthy individual. He had gotten fascinated by the notion of observing the surface of Mars, and he built his own observatory to do this, the Lowell Observatory, which remains an important observatory to this day. And at his observatory, he built a telescope, pointed it at Mars, saw what he thought were canals. And these canals seemed to be crisscrossing the surface of Mars. And so he wrote several popular books. I mean, he talked about this in the scientific literature. There's a lot of initial enthusiasm for this notion that there were canals on Mars in the scientific literature. He wrote several books that popularized this notion, a series of three books. And he, you know, first, and those started to appear in the 1890s. And all of a sudden, you know, that just captured everyone's imagination. And in some sense, you know, if Martians did not exactly take over the Earth in the 1890s, they certainly conquered the Earth's imagination. And so you see in that period of time, the book War of the Worlds comes out, yeah, you know, almost, you know, hard on the heels of Lowell's books, because it was just such an exciting concept, you know, this notion of life on Mars. And even though ultimately Lowell's ideas were refuted, I mean, we don't find canals on Mars, they have remained in the imagination of English speakers and of the world.
Ayres Aden is my guest. Let me jump in. We have to take a break. He is director of the Center for Genome Architecture at Baylor College of Medicine and assistant professor of computer science and applied math at Rice. His new book, Uncharted, Big Data as a Lens on Human Culture. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ayres Aden. He is assistant professor of computer science and applied mathematics at Rice University and director of the Center for Genome Architecture at Baylor College of Medicine. His new book is called Uncharted, Big Data as a Lens on Human Culture. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Ayres, some of this is unquestionably just sort of fascinating and fun, and you can, in fact, lose a great deal of time playing around with the Ngram Viewer, which we should say is available for free to anybody who wants to jump on and search a couple of terms. But there are other things. You know, you can search for zombie versus werewolf, but you can look at terms like obesity and autism, and the frequency with which they appear seems to at least somewhat reflect the increase in cases of these conditions, if not only of our awareness of them.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It is definitely the case that sometimes when there is an epidemic of something, you see people talking about it a lot more. That's not always, but one has to be careful, because it's not always the case that an epidemic is what's actually driving people's interest in a concept. For instance, discussion of polio increases actually a great deal right after the development of the polio vaccine, because it's actually the discovery of the fact that we can do something about it that is leading to the discussion rather than the reverse. Or for instance, in newspapers, you can actually see advertisements for pneumonia remedies. And so, you know, those will track very strongly with the season. And the reason for that is, you know, not necessarily that people are responding to an acute epidemic that is already happening, but rather because drug advertisers have known for many decades, going back well over a century, that there are certain times of year that people are more concerned about pneumonia. So cause and effect can be a little bit tricky. The other thing that can be tricky is nomenclature. For instance, if you look at a term like shell shock, the term shell shock had a huge spike right around the First World War. It has another smaller spike during the Second World War, and you also see terms like battle fatigue, which became sort of the more technical term for shell shock, appear during the Second World War. And of course, today we don't refer to these things as either shell shock or as battle fatigue. In fact, what we refer to them as is PTSD. So one has to be very, very careful, because medical language over the time frames that one can look at with the N-gram viewer is changing very dramatically. And no one's talking about PTSD during World War One. It's not because there wasn't PTSD during World War One. It's because they used to call it shell shock. So we have to be very, very careful about cause and effect when we're thinking about disease epidemics and N-gram data.
And of course, there are words that can be used for more than one thing. So I, for example, did a search, and I was curious about, you know, my grandmother would never have said someone was pregnant. She would have said, oh, she's expecting. And so I was curious about those two terms. And sure enough, in the late 50s, it looks like pregnant sort of takes off and expecting goes down. But of course, that's not a word that we use only to refer to being with child.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think one of the things that's very challenging about the N-gram viewer is sometimes things are ambiguous, and there's no easy way to look at the exact phenomenon that you want to look for, because expecting can be used in multiple ways. That said, so, you know, even as a verb, right, she's expecting, I don't know, my daughter is, you know, sometimes expecting me to give her, you know, right. A toy, mm-hmm. right? She's you're not expecting that relevant. So how do you disentangle that? It can be challenging, and sometimes the answer is you can't. With that said, I was able to, just now as we were talking, probe the phrase, she's expecting a baby. On the N-gram viewer, and, you know, the data is not quite as clean as you might like, because she's expecting a baby is a pretty rare phrase, but I don't see any evidence for who's expecting a baby before 1920. So although your grandmother might use she's expecting a baby, and maybe it's kind of old-fashioned in your eyes, relatively speaking, I would actually say, based on what I'm seeing in the N-gram viewer right now, and of course, this is an off-the-cuff analysis, happening live in real time as you're speaking. But actually, the signal is strong enough right now that I would venture to say, if I saw, you know, a TV show set in the Civil War and it used the phrase, she's expecting a baby, I think that would be an anachronism, actually, because I see really no evidence for the use of she's expecting a baby prior to 1900. You know, that said, you're right, that the term pregnant is certainly on the rise. But I think actually she's expecting a baby is actually also up and coming.
So is there any way to account, Erez, for the fact that anything that we have sort of written for publication is going to be likely conveyed in a different sort of language than we use on the street, than we use to talk to our best friends, than we would even use to write a letter to a loved one?
So actually, I just wanted to make a point that may be relevant to this your previous question, and I apologize for thinking that one. The phrase expecting a baby very, very, very clearly emerges. And I was just, you know, playing with this a little bit more. It's very addictive, even during, you know, radio interviews. It's hard to stop. Expecting a baby really only starts to pop up really right after 1920. That's very clearly a modern phrase. What's interesting is a phrase that goes back a long way is in the family way.
Oh.
Right? So that's a euphemistic expression. If your grandmother really wants it to be old-fashioned, she could say, oh, she's in a family way, or in the family way. And that is actually a very old-timey phrase. Anyway, I'm sorry, I want to get to your more recent question. So you asked this very, very important question, which is, look, books are just not representative of how we use language as a whole, right? I mean, look, you know, everyone knows that, you know, people, someone who they say, oh, well, he doesn't really self-censor very well. You know, like, he doesn't have a good distinction between his inside and his outside voice. You know, we think one thing, right? We say a different thing. And if we're saying it in different venues, we say it differently still, right? So something that gets written in a book is filtered in a certain kind of way. Its grammar is filtered. Its phrasing is filtered in a certain kind of way. The ideas that it discusses are filtered in a certain kind of way. Then, for instance, things that appear in newspapers. And that means that books are sampling, in some sense, only a tiny piece of the full picture. For instance, Britney Spears kind of doesn't get talked about as much as she ought to in books, in some sense. People think about Britney Spears much more in other media. Mm-hmm. They write about her, they talk about her much more in other media than they do in books. In contrast, differential equations. Right, you see lots of books about differential equations. You almost never see anything about differential equations in the news. Right, it's not that differential equations aren't interesting. It's not that there isn't news in the space of differential equations, mm-hmm. or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people use differential equations, you know, every day. But you don't read about them in the news. So you're completely right that different parts of the historical record filter our thoughts, filter what's on our mind in different ways, and one has to be very, very careful about that. One of the ways to get around that is simply to look at other types of corpora. So, for instance, at bookworm.culturalmix.org, we've made available similar tools that use historical newspaper corpora, or that use, you know, various types of online corpora, various types of magazines and publications. So you can see how does newspaper discussion differ from books. But ultimately, you know, all of these are simply imprecise ways of getting at the question that we really somehow want to get at, which is what's on people's minds. And you know what? Most people don't tell you most of the time what's on their minds. And most people, you know, and even the people who do occasionally get to write a book or write a newspaper article are a tiny minority of the population as a whole. Tragically, most of the thoughts that have ever been sunk by the human race are lost to us. And most of those voices aren't recorded. And one has to be very, very vigilant about that when thinking about n-gram data.
Well, what I love even about the obstacles that you run up against is that they lead us to new sort of critical ways of thinking about how we think and what we think.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting about this is that if you think about, you know, there's any number of questions in that are traditionally thought of as sort of questions of the humanities, you know, trying to understand, you know, what is the nature of the sort of human experience, where, you know, it's kind of funny, but like n-grams can give you a sense of that. You know, when did people start thinking of the United States as a single country, right? When did people, you know, start thinking that they have certain rights? You know, when do you start thinking about, like, civil rights, women's rights, you know, children's rights, animal rights? I mean, these are fundamental, deep concepts in terms of our self-conception of what it is to be human, right? What are the rights that a human has? And n-grams can tell us something that I think is helpful. Well, it's not answering the fundamental, deep questions, right? Those are, in some sense, above the pay grade of n-grams. But it can be, you know, it can be helpful. It can give you a little bit of insight. On, you know, when do those ideas come up? What are some of the ways in which rights movements can stimulate one another, et cetera? And that's, you know, that can be a pretty interesting thing. Actually, it's a profound, I'd love to give you actually one sort of example of this that I find is pretty profound.
Mm-hmm.
Just in terms of the ways that individual human decisions can be illuminated by engrams. I bet many of your listeners are familiar with Ilya Kazan, the very, very famous Hollywood director.
Mm-hmm.
Far fewer of them are probably familiar with Albert Maltz. And this is a little bit strange because up till the year 1947, year over year, Albert Maltz was a better known person than Ilya Kazan. But in 1947, both of them were asked to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee. And Maltz says, that's immoral. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to name names. You know, I'm not going to tell them who I think might be communist. Ilya Kazan says, you know, I don't like this idea. I'm really uncomfortable with it, but I don't want to lose my career over it. So he goes and he names names. Now, Albert Maltz, because he refuses to testify, ends up getting blacklisted in Hollywood. He's named actually one of the Hollywood Ten. Who are basically not allowed to participate officially in any official capacity in Hollywood productions because they've refused to name names. They're viewed as, you know, to some extent for a while, you know, as these persona non grata in Hollywood up till about 1960. Kazan is able to continue to function because he has named names. And in that period of time after 1947, he does some of his amazing work, you know, like on the waterfront with Marlon Brando, and becomes an extraordinarily famous person. Now, today, many people know who Ilya Kazan is, and many people actually remember of him that, you know, he named names. So he's famous, but it's not, you know, there's a little bit of infamy there, too. You know, he has this mixed legacy. On the other hand, very few people know who Albert Maltz is. It brings to mind for me, there's this scene in Pirates of the Caribbean where Johnny Depp's character, Captain Jack Sparrow, he's captured by someone. Someone grabs him, and he says, oh, my gosh, you're Captain Jack Sparrow. You're the worst pirate I've ever heard of. And Johnny Depp's character turns to him and says, ah, so you've heard of me. And to some extent, that is, you know, you understand the question that Albert Maltz and Ilya Kazan faced in 1947 this sort of different way. They made a single decision. Right, and the profound legacy of that decision could not be clearer in the engram data, and it's pretty astonishing to me and surprising to me that you can take something so complex, so subtle as the moral legacy of what was surely, you know, among the most difficult decisions that these folks made throughout their lives, and you can see the consequences of that quantitatively.
We just have about 15 seconds left, but I would gather that there is a lot to be learned just by tracking the kinds of things that plain old civilians like me are typing into this thing and what they're searching for.
People search for a lot of curse words. That's often the first go-to thing. After they do that, they often do, you know, interesting person-specific things. I met some dermatologists after, you know, typing in men, women, and, you know, all the initial things that people, they started typing in interesting skin diseases and told me all about their engrams. I often find that the fifth or sixth thing that people type into engrams starts to tell you something about them. It's like a little bit of their intellectual CV.
Erez Aydin's new book, written with Jean-Baptiste Michel of Harvard, is called Uncharted, Big Data as a Lens on Human Culture. Erez, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thanks so much. My pleasure. Take care.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.